They say in life, the older you get, the more you travel. We welcome this morning South Africa's own Ibn Battuta, known otherwise as Abu Bakr Dawji. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
As the hairline recedes, the voyager miles increase.
What a wonderful welcome, Maulana. I think I didn't like that older part.
Welcome back to South Africa.
Jazakallah khair, Maulana.
Story that caught your eye this week.
Well, nothing really. I think maybe we should just go into my trip to Bosnia. What do you think?
I thought maybe Halima Kala paid you a visit because she missed you while you were away.
I see you on the ball. I think your decoder was retuned, Maulana.
Okay, tell us about Bosnia.
Well, frankly, before I left for Bosnia, Maulana, I was wondering, a little bit apprehensive, what is it that we will be doing there? All I knew about Bosnia was that a terrible war took place there just over 20 years ago. My brother, in fact, was a journalist at that time, and he was stuck in Sarajevo for months. It was under siege, and people were starving, and the Serbian snipers were shooting people in the streets and so on. Anyway, it was his suggestion a couple of months ago that I should take people there. It's an amazing place, he said. Well, here I was taking 35 people, and so I was a little bit worried about how we were going to spend so many days there. What will we do? So let me tell you this. Bosnia-Herzegovina is one of the most incredible places I have ever visited. And everyone who went with me were absolutely thrilled at visiting this wonderful country. And, of course, we were very, very sad to leave there. First of all, it was a bit of a culture shock. It's a Muslim-majority country right in the heart of Europe. Islam was first brought into Bosnia around the end of the 15th century when the Ottomans gained control of Bosnia in 1463 and Herzegovina in 1480. By the end of the 1600s, approximately two-thirds of the population became Muslim, and they followed the Hanafi Mazhab. Right now, the population is made up of 40% Muslims, 31% Orthodox Serbs, and 15% Catholic Croats. So, why was it something of a culture shock? Well, to be honest with you, all of the Muslims looked totally like whites from maybe Norway or Sweden. I'm speaking about green eyes and blonde hair and brunettes and so on. Total 100% vetoes, not 50 shades of brown or black. Not like maybe the Jordanians or the Lebanese, who you can make out, you know, they have Arab features. These are vetoes out and out. When we went for Jummah Salah, I thought I was in a church in Bloemfontein. We were the only darkies there. It was like the invasion of the Bangladeshis. Our guide, while speaking, all through the trip, while speaking casually about various subjects, he was one day speaking about zikr, and he said he followed the Naqshbandi tariqa. Hey, that really floored us. All the terminology that they were using coming out of these whites. And everywhere you saw, this was another thing, everywhere you saw ladies in scarves and hijabs. Of course, there were others in modern clothing. Now, some of our brothers said to me, while their wives were some distance away, "Hell, bro, shame, man. How some of these ladies with torn jeans must be suffering, eh? Got no clothes. Maybe they are widows from the war. I think we should save them, brother." I told these brothers to foot check before I tell the pros. Widows from the war? The war was 20 years ago, and these girls were just about born at that time. It's amazing how our brothers get a sudden sense of compassion in certain circumstances. Now, here's the beauty of Sarajevo, where we stayed. We heard the azan from so many different directions. There are over 100 masajid in Sarajevo alone. Our guide said that he worked it out that there was a masjid at approximately every 600 meters. Hmm. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, there are 810 masajid. When you look down on Sarajevo, you see dozens of minarets. It's a wonderful feeling. A short walk down a hill from our hotel brought us to the main shopping area. Hundreds of lovely shops and small little shops and restaurants, a whole web, along a whole web of narrow pedestrian gullies, little avenues, shops selling locally manufactured goods, and coffee shops and restaurants with local cuisine, and halal signs all over the place. And Bosnians really love to eat meat. Dear listeners, Bosnia-Herzegovina is absolutely beautiful. To my great surprise, we had a jam-packed program. We visited amazing towns and cities from early in the morning to late at night. The countryside is at once like Switzerland and the next moment like the Natal Midlands, you know, when you're coming down from Harrismith. Greenery, tall pine trees, lush farmlands, so much to see. But let me tell you about the most important day of all. The most touching, moving, heart-wrenching, incredibly depressing, emotionally draining, yet spiritually uplifting day of the entire tour. The visit to Srebrenica. But let me first give you some background, Maulana.
Mm-hmm.
Some background. After the Second World War, the communists were on the side of those who defeated the Nazis. So they set up Yugoslavia, which was made up of six republics: Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia, Montenegro, and Macedonia. These six sort of provinces made up Yugoslavia. The population of Bosnia-Herzegovina at that time was 44% Muslim, 33% Serbs, and 13% Croats. The country was headed by Marshal Tito. After he died on the 4th of May 1980, people in the six republics began to have a feeling of nationalism and wanted to be independent in their own countries. Yugoslavia began to fall apart. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, on the 29th of February 1992, a referendum was held to ask the people if they wanted to be an independent country. The majority voted in favor, but the Serbs in Bosnia boycotted the elections because they wanted their part of Bosnia, you know, where they were in the majority, they wanted that part to join with neighboring Serbia. On the 6th of April 1992, Bosnia-Herzegovina was recognized as an independent country by the European Union, and the next day also by the United States. The Serbs in Bosnia had their own forces inside Bosnia, and they were backed by their neighbor Serbia. And so the Serbs in Bosnia began attacking the Bosnian Muslims and the Croats. That was the start of the massacres and ethnic cleansing. The Bosnian government had its own army, but it did not have as much weapons as the Serbs. Fighting broke out all over Bosnia-Herzegovina. But let me concentrate on Srebrenica. Serb forces had destroyed 296 villages around Srebrenica in just the first 3 months of the war, killing thousands and uprooting 70,000 people. From 1992 to 1993, Srebrenica was constantly attacked, but Bosnian forces, the Muslims, managed to hold it, and even they expanded the boundaries of Srebrenica. Muslims from outlying areas began pouring in, converging into Srebrenica, between 50 to 60,000 people. Then Serb forces surrounded Srebrenica and put it under siege. No food was allowed in, and the water system was bombed and destroyed. People were starving to death. Worst of all were the refugees, those who had just come into the city, who had entered Srebrenica from surrounding villages. They were sleeping in the streets with midwinter temperatures reaching minus 10 degrees. People were reduced to skin and bones, and they were dying out there in the street, women, children, old people. On the 16th of April 1993, the United Nations declared some of the towns in Bosnia as safe havens or safe areas, meaning that they would be under the control of the United Nations. Now, the Serbs were not allowed to attack these safe havens, and the Muslims had to surrender whatever arms that they had. while they were in that safe haven or these towns that were protected by the United Nations. The United Nations sent 400 Dutch soldiers to police Srebrenica. Imagine that, 400. On the 10th of July 1995, the Serb forces surrounded Srebrenica and moved in, and the Dutch soldiers of the UN just sort of like melted away. They just fell back and did nothing. On this last Monday of this week, we, our group, entered Srebrenica. We were told that the atmosphere in Srebrenica is one of sorrow and tragedy. We felt it. We felt this tragedy that took place 20 years ago as we entered the town. It's as if we were hearing the screams of the victims of the massacre that took place there. Across the road where our bus stopped was a massive, long, rectangular building. A huge place, stretching all along the roadside. This used to be a factory that manufactured batteries. When we walked in past the huge steel doors, there was a starkness about the place, high blackened walls. The Serbs had incarcerated thousands of Muslims here, men, women and children. I, myself, like those with me, stood there or slowly walked around this huge prison and tried to imagine what the people inside must have experienced. For example, they must be thinking, what's going to happen to us, to our kids, to the little babies, our children, our husbands? It must have been a time of deep terror. Then, after a few days, they were taken out and told to make two groups, women and children on the one side, and men and boys, even 12-year-olds on the other side. Buses were brought in, and the women and children were asked to board and were taken away to areas controlled by Muslim forces. But during all these days, while the people were locked up in this compound, the Muslim women especially the young girls, were raped and subjected to horrible abuse. Let me just quickly read to you one account. On July 12, 1995, as the day wore on, the refugees in the compound could see Serb soldiers setting houses and haystacks on fire. Throughout the afternoon, Serb soldiers mingled in the crowd and summarily executed men. In the late morning of 12 July 1995, a witness saw a pile of 20 to 30 bodies heaped up behind the building. Another testified that he saw a soldier slay a child with a knife in the middle of a crowd of these refugees. He also said that he saw Serb soldiers execute more than 100 Bosnian Muslim men in the area behind the factory and then load their bodies onto a truck. Soldiers were picking people out of the crowd and taking them away. A witness recounted how three brothers, one merely a child and the others in their teens, were taken out in the night. When the boy's mother went looking for them, she found them stark naked and with their throats slit. That night, a Dutch medical orderly witnessed two Serb soldiers raping a young woman. One survivor described the murder of a baby and the rape of women occurring in the close vicinity of Dutch UN peacekeepers who did nothing to prevent it. According to the survivor, a Serb soldier told a mother to make her child stop crying, and when it continued to cry, he took it from the mother and slit its throat, after which he laughed. And our guide also in this building told us that it happened to the other baby also, where the soldier kept on telling his mother over and over, stop your baby from crying, stop your baby from crying. Finally, he took the baby, threw it on the floor, and crushed its head with his boots. Stories about rapes and killings spread throughout the crowd, and the terror in the camp escalated. Several individuals were so terrified that they committed suicide by hanging themselves. And as we walked around in this huge building, we saw ropes hanging down from the ceiling, Maulana. It was such a grisly sight. Again, imagine the terrible feeling that gripped mothers whose sons and husbands were left behind in Srebrenica. The Serbs then started systematically killing all of these men and boys. Groups were taken out of the battery factory and machine gunned. Inside the factory was a huge TV screen when we went there now. We saw videos of Serbs mowing down teenage boys. The video was taken by Serbs themselves, Serb soldiers. In one video, we saw half a dozen boys, perhaps about 15 years old, with hands tied behind their backs, in filthy conditions, asked to jump out of the back of a truck. and marched to a bush along the roadside and told to lie down. But their fate was delayed because the truck had to go and get another battery for the video camera. The Serbs were enjoying themselves. Then we heard the machine gun fire. All dead. Yes, all dead. And you know what? Across the road from this battery factory, while we were there, we saw a terrible sight. It was the proof of the killing was right there. It was a dastardly crime. Hundreds of white pillars, tombstones, each one describing the dead. 14-year-old Salimovic Mahmoud, 49-year-old Sadiq Salim. Hundreds and hundreds of pillars, each telling a story of the massacres, dotted across a huge field. We all cried, some silently, some eyes filled with tears. 8,723 Muslims were buried there. Thousands more were unaccounted for because the Serbs, realizing what they had done, had dug up many and buried them all over Bosnia. No one knows how many. Mass graves are still being found today, and the bones are all mixed up, so there's a long and painful process of DNA matching to determine who was killed. And some who were identified were buried in freshly dug graves that we saw with green pillars. So mothers were still mourning 20 years after the massacre at Srebrenica. 20 years later, and a janaza salah is still taking place almost every day. We walk silently among the pillars. And if anyone wants to see the photos of this massive field of tombstones, send me a WhatsApp message, 082-352-3526, and I'll send these grisly photos of this very sad scene. I stood among the graves and wondered about the words expressed after the Holocaust, never again, never again. What a big lie. Tell that to the people of Rwanda who were murdered as the world watched. And never again did not apply to the Muslims of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Here's something else. Everywhere you go in the country, you see graves. Not in one corner of a town somewhere like we have here. No, right there in the city center or next to a shopping center. Hundreds of white pillars, sometimes forming a backdrop to a town. One person in our group observed that having these graves right there within the communities was a reminder that death is part of life. Graveyards were not scary places for the Bosnians, but reminders of our temporary stay in this world. And the Muslims of Bosnia are so amazingly strong, Maulana. Yes, they do speak about the impact of the massacre, even those who were very, very young at that time. Our guide Timur told us that his father was a fighter in one of the Muslim battalions. As usual, one day, the father was leaving home to go and fight, and asked Timur, who was just 4 years old, and he was being carried by his mother. The father asked him for a kiss. Timur said he turned his head away and said, no, no, to his father. His father asked him again and again, give me a kiss. Timur said, no, no, and kept turning away. The four-year-old Timur knew that his father was not coming back. Yes, indeed, he did not come back killed in the fighting. Everyone had a sad story to tell. But they are so strong, and they tell us that they rejoice that those who perished in the massacre are all a shaheed. That gives them strength and keeps them positive. They smile and laugh and are so warm, so welcoming. We felt a great love for these wonderful people. And we also felt positive hearing and seeing how much the iman was strengthened. I read that there is a resurgence of Islam among young people. And that's wonderful in a country that was under communist rule for so long, and not very long ago, where you were jailed if you went to the masjid. And so, and we were happy in spite of Srebrenica because these people were happy. It was not all doom and gloom, Maulana. And I must say, one of the highlights was when we were taken white water rafting. That's right. All of us wore life jackets and were taken to the top of the river. Actually, there were two options. For people who want to do white water rafting. White water rafting for 3 hours, where you wore helmets because it was worse than a roller coaster ride, and a 1.5 hour ride that was less bumpy. They took one look at us and decided that these Bangladeshis were unfit geriatrics, physically challenged, fit for the handicapped parking areas only. So we were told to do the 1.5 hour stretch. So with our life jacket, we got into inflatable rubber boats, rubber ducks, you know, and we looked like, well, we actually looked like ducks sitting in those rubber duckies. About 6 in each of the boats, each one given an oar to row. Wow, it was going to be an exciting journey. One by one, the boats took off. In my boat, I had a bully, a doctor and his vrouw. She sat on the floor of the boat. Two other people were at the back end of the boat. And off we went. And within 30 seconds, we went down a small waterfall, a rapid, and we got stuck among the rocks there. And the water started gushing into the boat. All happened in a split second. And everyone was screaming and shouting. And one of the oars disappeared also. I heard shouts of, Omar! And I'm sure I heard someone reading Kalema in the back there. And, you know, but I never saw a person swimming inside a boat before. That auntie sitting in the floor was huffing and puffing, swinging her arms. But our guide in the boat had took us out of this very quickly. And after that, we were just laughing and laughing, even though we went down to one or two other rapids. But it was a fantastic ride down the river. Stunningly beautiful. It's absolutely hard to describe. Clear, cool water, lush green vegetation on high hills on either side. And at the end, we were welcomed back at the raft station with a very tasty mixed grilled braai. Absolutely unforgettable experience. Actually, there's so much to tell, Maulana. We started our tour wondering what Bosnia-Herzegovina had to offer. And at the end, we felt that we did not get enough of this beautiful country and its beautiful people.
Sounds wonderful. Developments in Guantanamo Bay?
Well, George Bush described those who were locked up at Guantanamo Bay as the most dangerous terrorists in the world. My view, Maulana, is that those detainees should have been freed a long time ago, and George Bush should have been locked up at Guantanamo for lying that these men were dangerous and for lying that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. I said it before that most of those locked up were innocent, handed over to U.S. troops to collect maybe ransom or to settle some personal grudge. You didn't like someone? You told the Americans, sir, that man is Al-Qaeda, go get him. And after you do, please don't forget to give me some bakshish, okay? And so I was quite startled to read yesterday the headline. Only 3 of the 116 men still detained at Guantanamo Bay were apprehended by U.S. forces. This was said in the Guardian newspaper, reviewing some military documents that it has just uncovered. It says that the foundations of the guilt of the remaining 113, whom U.S. politicians often refer to as the worst of the worst terrorists, involves a degree of faith in the Pakistani and Afghan spies. A 2009 U.S. Senate report validated long-standing accounts that U.S. Special Forces paid locals for their aid, something human rights critics have said gave an incentive for Pashtuns to capture people and claim Al-Qaeda affiliations to credulous, believing Americans. Laura Pitter of Human Rights Watch said, there is great reason to disbelieve claims that detainees at Guantanamo are the worst of the worst, including the fact that many were sold to the U.S. for a bounty not based on any real quality intelligence the U.S. had gathered. So there you are, folks. Guantanamo Bay, another monument to American injustice. Some of these men have spent over 10 years in this jail for doing nothing. If we take it that Obama wanted to close Guantanamo as he planned when he became president, the task was impossible, because even today, every member of the party of dancers, that is the Republican Party, still describe the detainees as the worst of the worst, dangerous terrorists who must never be released. And finally, I wonder how is the petition asking for Guantanamo detainees to be given refuge here in South Africa, how is that going? I've been away, so I really don't know. I need to follow that one up.
Light at the end of the tunnel.
Light at the end of the tunnel. Well, I just got two quick ones for you. Ronnie from Nearbank went into Addington Hospital for a piles operation, but ended up with a cracked skull. A cracked skull. How did that happen? Well, after the operation, Ronnie's wife Pushpa was sitting at his bedside waiting for him to wake up. After an hour, Ronnie's eyes flickered open and he whispered, "Pushpa, you look so beautiful." And then he drifted back into sleep. After another hour, his eyes flickered open again and he said, "Pushpa, you look nice." And Pushpa replied, "What happened to beautiful?" And Ronnie replied, "I think the anesthetic is wearing off." Here's the last one. Ronnie took his dog, big dog, you got to say, in Bernard. He took it to the vet. "Hey, doc, I want you to do something. I want you to cut my dog's tail off." The vet was very surprised. "But Ronnie, why do you want to do such a thing?" And Ronnie replied, "Because my mother-in-law is coming over to my house tomorrow, and I don't want anything to make her think that she is welcome."
Okay, Levy, as always, jazakallah for your time. Much appreciated.
Always a pleasure, Maulana.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
13 to 9, we go for a quick break. When we come back, we're reading out a tribute. The Big Picture program was sponsored by Steering Auto Inspector Car in Benoni, the thinking person's car dealership. Steering Auto, the home of pre-loved cars.